Genocide begins. On Wednesday evening, April 6, a plane was shot down and it burst into flames near Kigali. On board were the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi. All lives were lost. Few people were aware of the crash that evening. The official radio station made no announcement. The three missionaries, the Bents and Henk, will never forget the days that followed. Brother Bent explains, "In the early morning of April 7, we awoke to the sounds of gunfire and explosions of hand grenades. This was not unusual because in recent months the political situation in the country had become extremely unstable. However, while we were preparing breakfast, we received a telephone call. A Manuel Inguirente, who was at the translation office, told us that the local radio station had announced the death of the two presidents in the plane crash. The Ministry of Defense warned everyone in Kigali not to leave their homes. About 9 o'clock in the morning, we heard looters smash into our neighbor's home. They stole the family's car and killed the mother of the family. Soon, soldiers and looters came to our home, banged on our metal gate, and rang our bell. We kept quiet and did not go outside to answer. For some reason, they did not attempt to force the gate, but moved on to other houses. The sound of automatic weapons firing and of explosions continued all around. There was no possibility of trying to leave. Gunfire was loud and near, so we went to the corridor between the rooms in the center of the house, where we would be protected from stray bullets. We realized that the situation was not going to end quickly, so we decided to ration our food supplies by preparing one meal a day, which we could share together. The next day, when we had just eaten lunch and were listening to the international news on the radio, Henk cried out, "They are coming over our fence!" There was little time to think. We went into the bathroom and locked the door. We then prayed together, asking Jehovah to help us endure whatever might happen. Before we had finished praying, we heard the militia and the looters smashing their way through the windows and doors. Within minutes, they were in the house, yelling and overturning furniture. There were about 40 looters, men, women, and children, along with the militia. We also heard shooting as people squabbled over articles they had found. After what seemed to be an eternity, but was only about 40 minutes, they tried the bathroom door. Then, because it was locked, they started to break it open. We now realized that we had to go out and show ourselves. The men were crazed and drugged. They threatened us with machetes and knives. Jenny was crying out loud to Jehovah. One man swung his machete, striking Henk with the flat side of the blade at the base of his neck. Henk fell into the bathtub. Somehow, I managed to find money and give it to the attackers. They fought over it. Suddenly, we became aware of a young man staring at us. Although we did not know him, he recognized us, maybe from the preaching work. He grabbed hold of us, pushed us back into the bathroom, and told us to shut the door. He said that he would save us. The sounds of looting continued for another 30 minutes or so, and finally, it became quiet. Eventually, the young man returned to tell us that we could come out. Insisting that we leave immediately, he led us out of the house. We did not stop to pick up anything. With horror, we saw the bodies of some of our neighbors who had been murdered. Two members of the Presidential Guard escorted us to a military officer's house nearby. The officer then escorted us to the Mille Collines Hotel, where many people had taken refuge. Finally, on April 11, we were evacuated to Kenya, after many more anxious hours and a stressful military operation that transported us on a roundabout route from the town to the back of the airport. We arrived at the reception area of Nairobi Bethel, uncombed and disheveled. Henk, who had been separated from us during the evacuation, arrived some hours later. The Bethel family overwhelmed us with loving care and support. The following is from page 194 of the printed edition. Within 100 days, a million died. The 1994 genocide in Rwanda represents one of the clearest cases of genocide in modern history. From early April 1994 through mid-July 1994, members of the small Central African States Majority Hutu ethnic group, systematically slaughtered members of the Tutsi ethnic minority. An extremist Hutu regime, fearing the loss of its power in the face of a democracy movement and a civil war, made plans for the elimination of all those, moderate Hutu as well as Tutsi, it perceived as threats to its authority. The genocide ended only when a mostly Tutsi rebel army occupied the country and drove the genocidal regime into exile. Over a period of only 100 days, as many as 1 million people lost their lives in the genocide and war, making the Rwandan slaughter one of the most intense waves of killing in recorded history. Encyclopedia of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. About 400 of Jehovah's Witnesses were murdered in the genocide, including Hutu, who were killed for protecting their Tutsi brothers and sisters. No witnesses died at the hands of fellow believers. Returning to the account. Saved by a little girl's prayer. On the day after the plane crash that killed the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi, six government soldiers went to Brother Rakabubu's house. Their eyes were bloodshot, their breath reeked of alcohol, and their manner indicated that they were drugged. They demanded weapons. Brother Rakabubu told them that he and his family were Jehovah's Witnesses and that they had no weapons. The soldiers knew that Jehovah's Witnesses, as neutrals, had refused to support the government and did not make contributions to the army. This enraged the soldiers. Gaspar and Melanie Rakabubu are not Tutsi, but the Hutu Interahamwe militia were killing not only Tutsi, but also moderate Hutu, especially if they were suspected of sympathizing with the Tutsi or the invading army. The soldiers hit Gaspar and Melanie with sticks and took them along with their five children into the bedroom. They stripped the sheets off the bed and started to cover the family with the sheets. Some had grenades in their hands, so their intentions were clear. Gaspar asked, "May we please pray?" One soldier contemptuously refused their request. Then, after some discussion, the soldiers reluctantly agreed to let them pray. "Okay," they said, "you can pray for 2 minutes." They prayed silently, but Deborah Rakabubu, who was 6 years old, prayed out loud, "Jehovah, they want to kill us. But how will we be able to make return visits on the people I preached to with Papa, where I placed 5 magazines? They are waiting for us to call back, and they need to know the truth. I promise you that if we are spared, I will become a publisher, get baptized, and be a pioneer. Jehovah, save us." At hearing this, the soldiers expressed amazement. Finally, one of them said, "Because of this little girl's prayer, we will not kill you. If others come here, you tell them that we have already been here." The footnote reads, "Deborah did become a publisher, got baptized at the age of 10, and now serves with her mother as a regular pioneer." End of footnote. The situation worsens. Gradually, the war intensified as the invading army, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, made further advances on the capital, Kigali. This spurred the desperate Interahamwe militiamen to carry out more killings. Roadblocks manned by soldiers and armed Interahamwe militiamen, along with local residents, were set up throughout the town and at all road junctions. All able-bodied men were forced to man the roadblocks with the Interahamwe, night and day. The purpose of the roadblocks was to identify and murder Tutsi. As the killing continued throughout the country, hundreds of thousands of Rwanda's inhabitants left their homes. Many of them, including Jehovah's Witnesses, sought refuge in nearby Congo and Tanzania. The following is from page 197 of the printed edition. Death Chambers. Organizers of the genocide exploited the historic concept of sanctuary to lure tens of thousands of Tutsi into church buildings with false promises of protection. Then Hutu militia and soldiers systematically slaughtered the unfortunate people who had sought refuge, firing guns and tossing grenades into the crowds gathered in church sanctuaries and school buildings, and methodically finishing off survivors with machetes, pruning hooks, and knives. The involvement of the churches, however, went far beyond the passive use of church buildings as death chambers. In some communities, clergy, Catechists and other church employees used their knowledge of the local population to identify Tutsi for elimination. In other cases, church personnel actively participated in the killing.
From Christianity and Genocide in Rwanda.
The main allegation concerning the Catholic Church is that it switched its allegiance from the Tutsi elite to the creation of a Hutu-led revolution, thereby assisting in Habyarimana's subsequent rise to power in a majority Hutu state. In terms of the actual genocide, critics once again hold the church directly responsible for inciting hatred, sheltering perpetrators, and failing to protect those who sought refuge within its walls. There are also those who believe that as the spiritual leader of the majority population in Rwanda, the church is morally responsible for failing to take all available measures to end the killing.
From Encyclopedia of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity.
Returning to the account. Facing war and death. The following are accounts of our brothers and sisters as their world fell to pieces around them. Remember that Jehovah's Witnesses in Rwanda had undergone fiery tests in the 1980s, tests that had strengthened and refined their faith and courage. Their faith enabled them to remain no part of the world by refusing to participate in elections, local defense, and political affairs. John 15:19. Their courage helped them to face the consequences of that refusal: scorn, imprisonment, persecution, and death. Those tested qualities, along with their love of God and neighbor, enabled Jehovah's Witnesses not only to have no part in the genocide, but also to risk their lives to protect one another. There are many experiences that have not been included. Most brothers would prefer to forget the horrible details, since they do not seek vengeance. It is our hope that the story of their faith can inspire all of us to show more fully the love that identifies true disciples of Jesus Christ.